Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Hey everyone, Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com, we've done your homework.
Hey everybody, it's your old pal Josh. Sorry to cut in, but just for a second, I wanted to let you know that I'm doing my solo live show, The End of the World, or How I Learned to Start Worrying and Love Humanity, in Minneapolis and in D.C. On June 19th, I'll be in Minneapolis at the Parkway Theater, and you can get tickets by going to theparkwaytheater.com. The next night, June 20th, I'll be in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, to bring the good word to our nation's capital. I'll be there at the Miracle Theater, and you can get tickets to that one at themiracletheater.com. Thanks a lot for coming to see me. I'll see you this June.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and there's Jerry over there. And this is Stuff You Should Know. Barcodes. Give me some barcodes. I love them barcodes a lot. You like barcodes too?
Sure.
I'm feigning geeking out because I think barcodes are cool, but I'm not like a barcode nerd.
No, but it is interesting that like how much we take them for granted and how they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And after you listen to this or we research this, you'll probably start noticing them and being like, what secrets lie within you?
Exactly.
Little black things and spaces in between.
Well, hopefully if they listen to this, they won't have any questions like that. They'll know all the barcode secrets.
Well, sure.
I hope.
Yeah.
We'll find out.
We'll see.
So, like you said, barcodes are absolutely everywhere. And it is one of those things where you're like, there's one. Oh my gosh, there's one. There's one over there. Like if you work at a company, turn your computer over. Guarantee there's a barcode underneath. There's barcodes all over the place, right?
There's one on your forehead.
There is. Got it tattooed this morning just for this episode.
Wasn't that in a movie, I feel like? Of like
probably.
Future world where we all have barcodes.
Was it in 1984?
Like the government to put them on our necks.
Oh, maybe it was that Apple ad. It was maybe. The Apple ad.
Was it?
Probably. I know exactly what you're talking about. I can see a guy with a shaved head in a suit with a barcode on the back of his neck.
All right. Well, I hope there's people yelling at their radio right now.
Right. So they're everywhere.
Their radio.
They're on your computer. Uh-huh. They're on guys' necks. They're on the computer or on the radio.
Yeah.
And they're actually not that old of an invention.
Yeah.
Let me rephrase that, Chuck. They are exactly as old as you would imagine them to be.
Right, which is, if you thought about it, this is one of those things where if you ask someone, they'd probably be like, I don't know.
But stop talking to me.
If you gave a little bit of thought, you might think of the other half of what makes a barcode necessary or able to be used, which is the laser.
Wow, man.
And
that was the big reveal.
Well, they can't have preceded the laser.
No. It kind of did, actually, though.
Well, yeah, sure. The idea, but it took them in concert to actually do anything worthwhile.
Right, exactly.
Like so, you and me.
Basically, we're both just a couple of lumps and put it together and whew,
we're one big lump.
We took off like the UPC code protocol. So back, let's set the scene, shall we?
All right. Are we way back in it here?
Sure.
All right.
Jerry? Thank you, Jerry. Jerry launched us. So when you think about barcodes, you think grocery store typically, right?
I think anything, but sure.
I think grocery store.
I think anything you can, anywhere you can buy something or yeah.
Okay. That's much more dead on, but mine makes sense too, because it was in the grocery store that the whole issue of barcodes, the whole reason we have barcodes to begin with, really began. Because it used to be a genuine bona fide mess going to the grocery store.
Yeah. I mean, and this was back when people weren't even in a hurry.
Yeah, imagine now.
Like my mom was a cashier at Kroger in the 1960s.
Oh, wow.
So she has remarked about how fast she was typing in those numbers and how people like going through her line because she was just brruh, brruh.
Right. She was typing in those numbers is the key here.
Yeah, but no, I mean, there is no, well, we haven't done the John Henry test. Maybe right. Maybe Diane was so fast.
It's possible.
That she could beat the laser, especially these days, because, you know, sometimes it seems like they can take longer when they scan it and scan it and scan it
and
then type in the tiny number.
Right. But your mom may have been an anomaly. For the most part, if you went and checked out in a line at a grocery store, you had to wait way longer than you do these days because it wasn't Chuck's mom who was checking you out. It was some other person who had to lift up the can, find the price label on it, type in the price, type in the tax, and then pick up the next thing and do the same thing.
And heaven forbid that sticker fell off.
Yes. Or
then you got to call Earl over.
Right.
Earl's got to go to aisle 7.
Price check on aisle 7, Earl.
See what the Alpo costs.
So you've got that problem, right?
Yes.
If it goes on sale, that's another thing too.
Forget about it.
Have to go through and relabel all those cans, right? So that's where you got the price. It was labeled by some guy with a gun. Remember that movie, Oh God, with John Denver and George Burns?
Do I remember it?
I always, whenever I hear of a dude like pricing a something in a supermarket with a price gun.
That sound is so great.
That's what I think of. I think the first scene where he meets God.
Yeah, he was a supermarket manager, right?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
So that's how the price got on there. That was one problem that you had, hand labeling prices and then hand typing it in. But there's also the key of inventory.
Sure.
The only way to tell how much stuff you had in a store at any given time was to go through and count everything in the store and in the back room.
Yeah.
And then you would know what you needed to order. So supermarkets were frequently out of stuff. The lines were very long. It was a nightmare unless your mom was the cashier, which is one reason why barcodes were first invented and adopted into grocery stores, because it became so clear so early on that they could solve this enormous problem in one fell swoop if they could only get a system in place that perfected it.
Yeah. So in the 30s, there was a guy who wrote a thesis paper at Harvard named Wallace Flint, where he invented an automated grocery system with punch cards and flow racks and such.
Right.
Didn't really take off, but it was an interesting precursor, I think.
Anytime you have punch cards involved, it's not going to take off.
Right, unless that's how we vote in this country.
Right.
And you see how that worked out.
Right.
So flash forward to Philadelphia in the 1940s. There was a grocery store manager who was like Josh. He was pretty upset and riled up about time and how long it's all taking.
Right.
And running out of stuff. And he went to Drexel, I guess – it's Drexel University now. Was it Drexel IT back then, or was it two different things?
Could be an offshoot. Maybe they're copycats.
All right.
Well, they're like, yeah, we're in Drexel too.
I looked at their mascot, by the way.
The what?
They're the Dragons, and specifically their mascot that dresses up for basketball games is Mario the Magnificent.
Huh. It's a little odd for a dragon.
Yeah, he's named after apparently their like oldest basketball fan or something.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Sure.
Who happens to be a dragon.
At any rate, go Dragons. So like I said, 1947, can you help me, Drexel? I need help because I'm a grocery store manager. It's taken forever. The dean said, no, not really. But there was a student there, a grad student named Bob Silver, who stuck that in his pocket, as they say, walked away and went to his friend who was a grad of Drexel named Joe Woodland, because I guess he knew Joe was the man for ideas like this.
Sure.
And Woodland said, yeah, I think we could come up with something.
He said, we're in Philadelphia. Let's go down to Miami Beach and think about this.
Yeah, because years from now, that's where the I smell will be dreamed up.
It was Miami Beach, too. That's why it seemed familiar, wasn't it?
Yeah, it seemed familiar to me. And I was like, wait a minute. Oh, that's right. The eye smell.
So the eye smell and the UPC symbol were both dreamed up on Miami Beach.
And Two Life Crew.
Well, sure.
So, yeah, apparently he goes to the beach, starts dreaming of like Morse code. Basically, what he's trying to figure out is what can we use to represent like the price and mm-hmm. like the stock number. That's really what they were trying to boil it down to.
Yeah, because
initially.
If you have that in one little component, then that can be scanned. And
you
like,
wanted to say barcode, but it didn't exist yet.
Right, exactly. It could be scanned. It could be typed in, however you need to do it.
Sure.
But it could bring up a lot more information.
Right.
And you could do it a lot faster because it could tell you things like, there's only two left, you better order. Right? That kind of thing.
Right.
So, like you said, he figured out Morse code. He was kind of inspired on Miami Beach to use Morse code. But then something really weird happened. He typed some lines and some dots.
Typed?
With his fingers.
Oh, okay. In the sand, right?
In the sand, right?
Okay. He typed in the sand.
And then he just pulled his fingers downward in the sand and turned them into lines.
I figured he was drunk or something.
Maybe so.
And just kind of...
He was slurring his sand lines, right? And... that was the beginning of the first UPC symbol, and it was way different than what you would think because what they ended up coming up with was not just lines like we see today, mm-hmm. but circles, concentric circles like a bullseye.
Yeah, it looks like a record, like an LP.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, well put.
So that was it. Like, if this was the movie, and after all, they made a movie about windshield wipers with Greg Kinnear. Mm-hmm. So why hasn't this been made?
I don't know.
That would be the moment where he draws those lines in the sand and like a halo glows around them.
Mm-hmm.
And like...
Two Live Crew starts playing in the background. Your number, Hoochie Mama.
Oh, how great would that be? So yeah, that's where it was born. In 1949, those two dudes, Woodland and Silver, they came up with a machine... Because that was kind of the problem. It's like, great, we figured out this barcode thing, but it's useless unless you had a reader. And their reader was huge and expensive and heavy and dangerous, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was like the size of a desk. And back then, desks were really big.
That's like the size of a bus today.
They also used an oscilloscope as the reader, right? Which I, for the life of me, can't figure out how they did that. Because that detects like electrical pulses. But... the upshot of it was that oscilloscope with a 500-watt bulb that got super dangerously hot.
Sure.
When they put it together, what those two kids, these were grad students at the time, or they had just recently graduated, they had put together the first machine that could read printed material.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Right. So it just so happened that printed material was a printed bullseye UPC code.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big problem, though. They were missing something very important, and that was a microcomputer. Something that could read this code and make sense of it. They hadn't quite come up with that. So they said, you know what? Let's just forget about this. We'll put it in Dad's garage like a trampoline, sell it to RCA.
Well, yeah, they sold the patent, right?
Right. And then we're going to head off to go work for IBM. And that's where the big scene with the glowing and Two Live Crew would have ended. Maybe in a montage or something.
Right. So I spoiled it, I guess, with the laser, but in 1960 was when the first laser was debuted, and this was really key to read this thing, because the reason they used a 500-watt light bulb wasn't because they were just like, man, this is so cool and hot and dangerous.
Right.
Like, you needed a tremendous amount of light to read these tiny, super detailed. You know, it's not detailed with like lettering that we're used to seeing, but
no.
It was you had to read the detail.
Right, and it also has to be kind of small too.
Yeah, it can't be the size of the can.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, something bigger than the size of the can. It has to be fairly small, and it is fairly detailed.
Yeah.
And so you need a really bright light to read it. Well, luckily, eventually, the Hughes Corporation came up with the laser, and that was very quickly implemented with the barcode system. Not in grocery stores at first, but on the railroad, it turns out.
Yeah, this was, this guy figures pretty prominently. His name is David Collins, and he had a company called Computer Identics Corporation. And what he came up was the first, in 1969, the first barcode reader that actually worked.
without, you know, 500-watt light bulbs using that laser.
To keep track of freight cars, because the railroad companies would swap freight cars with one another all the time, but you'd end up, some guy would always keep your freight car and be like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so he sold two of those in 1969, MIT grad, and that kind of changed the game because all of a sudden it was being implemented, not in grocery stores, like you said, but grocery store people, workers, managers, owners.
Industry leaders, I think.
They took notice.
They did, especially a guy named Alan Halderman, who basically led the charge to get this stuff into supermarkets. And there was a pilot program that was at a Kroger, like the one your mom worked at, about the time where she would have worked for Kroger.
Yeah.
But this is up in Cincinnati, which I think is where Kroger was founded.
Yeah, she was in Tennessee, I think.
And RCA had been looking for new projects to work on, and they found this old patent that RCA bought from Woodland and Silver.
Yeah, what about this old thing?
They're like, what is it, a bullseye? They're like, no, check it out. So they put laser to bullseye and ran this pilot program in Cincinnati at Kroger, and it went okay-ish.
For a new thing, it did all right, but we mentioned how they had to be able to read these intricate little barcodes. Mm-hmm. Printing wasn't great, so any smudges or smears or anything would just throw the whole system off.
Right, but it was enough of a proof of concept that these grocery store industry leaders led by Alan Halderman said, we've got to get this out into grocery stores. So they formed...
We got to mention the name of their group.
You ready for it? Okay. They formed the U.S. Supermarket Ad Hoc Committee on a Uniform Grocery Product Code.
What does that spell? U-S-A-H-C-U-G-P-C. Yeah, it spells nothing, really.
Nothing.
Yeah. It spells a barcode.
I read somewhere that this guy, he would, when he was lobbying supermarket managers and leaders, I guess, to like buy into this, he would take them to go see Deep Throat. I read that it was the fashion of the day to like go out for a steak dinner, and then everybody went and watched Deep Throat in the movie theater as part of like a business meeting.
Yeah, do you get the steak dinner before or after that movie?
Before, apparently.
That's a really tough call.
Right.
Oh, dear. Well, let's take a break and ruminate on that question, and we'll be right back.
Hey everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace.
Hey friends, as every parent knows, kids seem to be everywhere all at once, and it's really tough for even the most watchful moms and dads to protect their little ones from every single thing.
Yeah, Duracell understands this, and that's why they're deeply committed to lithium coin battery safety. Lithium coin batteries power a bunch of important things around people's homes, including things young children may have access to. So Duracell not only educates parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of lithium coin battery safety, they also make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them.
Even Duracell's packaging is child secure and designed to avoid accidental opening, because they believe their product should provide more than just power. They should also provide peace of mind. You can learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes. Check.
So the U.S. Supermarket Ad Hoc Committee on a Uniform Grocery Product Code is hanging out at Deep
Throat.
Call
them the Ad Hoc Committee?
In the porno theater.
Uh-huh.
Sure, we can call them the Ad Hoc Committee from now on.
All right.
I just wanted to get it in one more time. And they decided that, yes, the RCA patent with the bullseye was pretty good, but it hadn't worked that good.
Yeah.
Is it possible there's something better? And this is pretty forward-thinking at the time, if you think about it, to say, like, yes, this works. This company has a patent on it. Mm-hmm. Forget about that. Could we do better? And they actually launched, like, a national, basically a competition to come up with something better.
Yeah, and this was sort of in the face of manufacturers who weren't too crazy about this idea to begin with, because mm-hmm. it would be on them, obviously, like Campbell's Soup, to start putting these codes on their soup cans. And no one really wanted to do it because of they had their own systems in place. It would cost them money and time.
Right.
And they were just like, hey, it ain't broke on our end.
What's funny is this article, I think this part came from a Smithsonian article where they're saying, like, cardboard manufacturers thought it would spoil their product. They're like, it's so beautiful. This box of apple cinnamon oatmeal cannot be spoiled with right. with a UPC code.
Yeah, that's weird.
But that was part of the pushback, apparently, was they thought it would mess up the product.
Right, but they gave in, I guess. I'm sure they were talked into the fact that they could move more product with this in the end.
They were taken to see Deep Throat, and they just caved like a house of cards.
They're like, man, that steak was good, and so was the cinema. So seven people, like you said, submitted, seven companies. And if you go and look at these seven submissions, it's interesting that some of them, like one was like the LP bullseye. Mm-hmm. There was another circular one, but it looked like
Webdings.
No, it looked like if a kid draws a sunshine, it was like all the lines were going out from the center.
Right.
There were a few different variations. It sort of looked like the modern barcode in theory. But then it's so funny when you look at the seven side by side, you immediately go to that little rectangular one. You're like, yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Just because we're used to it. But I don't know if at first if people just looked at it like the bullseye one was pretty.
It is pretty.
The sunshine one was nice.
I think I've seen the sunshine one on like cartons of milk or orange juice, like on the bottom of paper cartons. I've seen that before. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So I guess somebody adopted it.
There was a little half circle one too that looked sort of like a rainbow sticker. It's very cute.
That is cute.
But
I love rainbows.
The kicker here is that IBM sort of at the 13th hour, I guess, heard about this. We're like, hey, yeah, we'll throw in a bid. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, well, what have you developed? And they're like, well, we haven't developed anything because we just heard about this.
Right. But
the tech grapevine.
Joe Woodland, the guy who invented this other one, works for us.
Sure. Ironically, Joe Woodland didn't have anything to do with their design, though.
I know.
Who was it? George Laurer was the guy's
name. This story is all over the place.
It really is interesting how many different like directions it took.
How many times they saw Deep Throat over and over again as this process was going on.
Just stop saying those words. Just say cinema.
Okay.
But there was a guy there named George Laurer at IBM, and the advantage he had, or at least as he saw it, and I agree, is that he hadn't seen all these bullseyes and sunshines and rainbows, and he kind of started from scratch.
Right.
And built that beautiful little rectangle.
That was his premise, that he was like, I'm unadulterated with any preconceptions. IBM didn't have any pre-existing machinery that this thing needed to fit into.
Nothing.
He got to start from scratch. And actually, his idea panned out because his was selected. The ad hoc committee, mm-hmm. I'll spare everybody, met in New York, and they actually tapped some scientists from MIT because they said, who are the smartest scientists around? MIT scientists.
Sure.
Here are the, how many was it? 7 or 11 designs?
7.
Okay. Here are the 7 designs, MIT scientists. Mm-hmm. You guys tell us which one you think is right. But then this Alan Haberman, he said, hold on, before you guys tell us, can you give me a confidence interval of how confident you are mm-hmm. that you have picked the right one. And all of them were at like 90%. I'm 90% confident. And it was Laurer's rectangle that won.
That's right.
Ta-da!
Interestingly, they had demonstrated the rectangular one with a beanbag ashtray.
And the ace softball picture.
Yeah, which is...
Pitcher.
Like, is there anything better than the beanbag ashtray? Those are great.
Yeah.
We got those in college. Like, I searched them out.
Oh, really?
Just because they, you know, because they were always plaid and looked like they were from the 50s.
You never smoked, did you?
Well, I mean, I smoked a little in college, but we had ashtrays around. You still wanted to provide for your guests.
I see.
This is in college, you know.
Sure, yeah.
I have
yeah.
ashtrays.
Right. Maybe a little snack caddy to go with the cocktails.
But we had a few of those beanbag ashtrays, and they were pretty great, and mostly because you could put them on a dashboard of a car.
Yes.
And they would stay there.
Right. Or on your belly while you're pooping.
Sure.
Sure. They'd stay wherever you want them to.
So, like you said, Laura won. They had a big party, I'm sure, with rectangular hors d'oeuvres all arranged in perfect lines.
Eaten out of beanbag ashtrays.
Oh, God. And then on June 26, 1974, they debuted it in a real store in Troy, Ohio, Marsh Supermarket.
Yeah, I've not heard of it.
I thought you might have been like, oh, yeah, the old days of the Marshes in Toledo.
No, we had IGA, Foodtown, Kroger. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all I can remember.
And Foods with a Z?
Foods. I don't know why that got me.
That's the first thing I can think of. So they had this, the whole checkout counter, I see, is translated in today's dollars, but $44,000 is what that thing would have cost today.
Yeah, and just the scanner itself was more than $17,000 of that.
In today's dollars.
Yeah.
That's
and
crazy.
Today you can get a scanner for about $120. So this is a pretty nice setup for the Marsh's store in Troy, Ohio.
Yeah.
And
it's just one register too, right?
It was, out of however many. The rest of them were having the type. And they're
still
like, can't you be more like Sharon Buchanan, who's over here on the the laser checker?
Yeah, that was the real name, by the way. It sounds like you just totally improv'd that.
No, it came out of my memory.
No, but we should give her due.
Yeah, she was the first cashier to scan an item with a UPC code. And the first item that was scanned was a 10-pack of Juicy Fruit gum.
Yeah, I bet the guy, what was his name? Richard Dawson? No. That was Family Feud.
Clyde Dawson, his brother.
Right. He was the head of R&D for Marsh, and he played the first shopper.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if he was like, let's see, because his fruit stripes is nothing but striped lines.
Right.
I wonder if he was trying to throw him off.
I don't know.
Like, scan this.
Supposedly, he chose gum because a lot of people were like, well, what about gum? You're never going to be able to get one of these things on gum. But then he chose a 10-pack of gum.
Right.
So he was kind of hedging his bets. Whatever. But
I wonder
what
the smallest barcodes are.
The smallest I saw, they have
like
bees.
Now.
Bees have barcodes like on them somehow. I haven't figured out how. I didn't see how. I just know that bees have barcodes.
You mean bees the insect?
Yes, with a Z.
What do you mean? To track them or something?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So that's got to be pretty small. But the smallest product I saw with the barcode is Tootsie Roll Pop sticks have the barcode on them.
Really?
Huh?
Did you do research or you were just eating a Tootsie Roll Pop?
I was
down?
Like, well, I'll be darned.
Wow. How many licks did it take to get to the center?
I've never made it.
All right.
I always crunch, like the owl says.
So I guess we should talk about how these things work because it's interesting. It's super wonky.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I don't know, it's good for people to understand this to a certain degree, whatever degree you're comfortable with learning.
Well, okay. You ready?
Yeah, well, first, there's two kinds. We should differentiate between the barcodes and QR codes.
Yeah, a barcode is technically a linear 1D code.
Yeah, just dumb code.
Just lines, basically.
Yeah.
The 2D codes, like the QR, quick response codes, like the ones you see on, you know, happening products and items these days, marketing materials, maybe someone's
still a thing?
Business card. It's actually becoming even more of a thing from what I understand, just because there's so much stuff you can encode in it.
Right. How many characters? Like 800 and something?
Yeah, you can encode 7,000 digits or 4,000 characters of text.
Oh, okay.
And so you can encode some pretty sophisticated stuff in there. So people encode web addresses or pictures or whatever.
I've seen them on tours. Like you can do a QR code and bring up like a bunch of text about the painting or whatever.
And I think it's kind of, yes, I've seen that as well.
Yeah.
I think that it's kind of becoming less popular as a marketing tool.
Okay.
But simultaneously, it's becoming more popular
in just about every other
like
use.
Practical use.
Yeah. Barcodes, on the other hand, the 1D barcode can hold up to 85 characters. So these 2Ds are like exponentially more potent storehouses of information.
Yeah, but I like the simplicity of the barcode.
I do too.
It's pretty cool. Like you don't need, it does exactly what you need and nothing else.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And so when we're talking about a barcode, most people think of a universal product code,
yeah,
which is a 1D linear barcode. It's a type of it. It's not the only kind. There's a bunch of 1D linear barcodes, but the most readily recognizable one, especially in the U.S. and Canada, mm-hmm, is called the UPC.
Right. So let's say you're a company and you have a product that you want to debut. And what you would do is, since 1977, you would ring up a company out of Brussels called GSI.
GS1.
Oh, is that a one?
Mm-hmm.
No, don't call GSI.
No.
You're not going to get your stuff on the shelves.
Grime scene investigation.
Oh, God. Man, you were just flying with the...
Zingers?
Yeah. All right.
Not all of them are good.
Well, I didn't say they were.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I was like, save your applause, Chuck.
I'll save it. So the GS1, what you do is you pay an annual fee as a manufacturer, mm-hmm, and then you say, hey, I have this new thing. I want to apply for permission to enter the UPC system.
That's the Marshall Brain way of putting it.
Yeah. Basically like, hey, I want to be registered in the official system.
Right.
They write back and they say, all right, here, new manufacturer, you have a six-digit identification number. Mm-hmm. I imagine if you were like the Coca-Cola company, you're already set up with this.
Well, so they had to eventually start somewhere.
Well, right. But now when Coke develops a new product or whatever, mm-hmm, they just give them the new...
The item number is what
it's
called.
Item number, exactly. Yeah.
So the first six numbers. So if you look at a UPC barcode, mm-hmm, there are a bunch of bars, mm-hmm, and that's for the computer to read. And then there's 12 numbers. That's for humans to read and actually punch in if the machine has problems with it.
Right.
Okay. So it's actually the same information, but in two different languages, technically.
So you could technically probably teach yourself that language if you just looked at these long enough.
You totally could. You could.
It's interesting.
It would be probably the most useless thing you've ever done in your life,
uh-huh,
especially if you're not in the UPC code industry, and there is an industry.
Oh, sure.
But you could do that.
Yeah.
And we're going to teach you how.
Right. In a minute. But if at every big company, there is a UPC coordinator, and I imagine full departments that handle the stuff.
It depends. You can also, if you're a small company, you can contract out with a company that basically does that for you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like if you want to sell on Amazon, but you're not like a big company,
right,
you have to have a UPC symbol, but it could make no sense money-wise for you to go to GS1 and get a UPC symbol rather than,
right,
just getting it from a reseller.
Yeah. So if you're a huge corporation, though, it's in-house. You have a coordinator and a team. And anytime you have a product or launch a new product, you're going to have to assign that new product a number. And it's got to be very specific to that product. You can't just say, well, you know, Coke is Coke. So 2-liter, 12-pack, single, 12-ouncer, 16-ouncer, they're, mm-hmm, all the same.
Right, which means that the first six numbers of a UPC code for Coke is going to be the same on any bottle or can or whatever you pick up of Coke, because
and
that
it essentially says the Coca-Cola company in whatever language, right?
To the entire world.
Yeah.
Anywhere in the world where they use barcodes, if it gets scanned, it's going to come up as a Coke product.
That's right.
Those last five numbers, it's up to Coke and that UPC coordinator that's employed by Coke, mm-hmm, to come up with new numbers for each, not just Coke and Diet Coke and New Coke and Cherry Coke,
yeah,
and Orange Vanilla Coke, which have you had? It's weirdly good.
No.
You have to come up with not just a different number for each of those. You have to come up with a different number for each of those in each size and each way that those sizes are put together.
Yeah, every SKU, as they call it in the business.
Right. So a different one for one 12-ounce can of Coke or a six-pack of Cokes or case of Cokes, and so on and so forth. And I was on that GS1 site, and the way that they put it is much simpler. If you have one t-shirt that you sell, mm-hmm, right, It's a vitamin SYSK t-shirt.
Okay.
Which you can get.
Even better.
It's a great t-shirt, if you ask me.
You like that one, right?
I love it.
Yeah.
I think it's the colors on it that really get me.
Sure.
But you have one t-shirt, a vitamin SYSK shirt, but that thing comes in four different sizes, small, medium, large, extra large. Mm-hmm. And it comes in four different colors. You need 64 different, is that right? 4x4, 16x4 is 64. You need 64 different UPC codes.
Yeah.
For that one product, that one t-shirt.
And UPC code is one of those dumb things like, say, an ATM machine.
What do you mean?
Well, automatic teller machine.
Right, yeah.
Universal product code.
You know, thank you for calling me out on that. I actually went through this article and like got the instances of UPC code. Like, I defy you to find UPC code in the article.
And got rid of them all?
Yeah. Didn't stick in the
retail. Oh, everyone says it. So I wasn't being pedantic, but I was doing it for the people who are already thinking that.
And all right. there were people out there thinking that.
So the last digit is called a check digit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically a bit of a fail-safe to make sure that the scanner got everything right.
Yeah, it's really convoluted how it does that, though.
Yeah, there is a calculation every time you scan something, or every time something is scanned for you, rather. Do you check out yourself at the grocery store? Do you like that deal?
I don't, because I very strongly clearly see that they're replacing human cashiers, and I think human cashiers like to do human cashier work, so I go to the human cashier whenever I can.
Oh, I love the self-checkout.
Do you really?
Yeah, because I like bagging my stuff very specifically.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I do it.
Like cold with cold, or chunky items, or stuff that contain fat?
I mean, what? You know, I could go over my whole system.
I'd like you to.
Bore everyone to tears.
Come on.
But a lot of cold with cold, size, like sizes. Where it goes in my house as I'm unpacking.
Oh, that makes sense.
And more than anything, just efficiently packed.
Right.
So it all fits. I have a bit of a Tetris-y brain when it comes to packing things. Yeah. And so I get a little, I get really uncomfortable when I see someone else doing it and it's all wrong.
Oh, really? Yeah. Even when it's not your groceries? Like if you look over and somebody else
is? Oh, no, I don't know.
I got you.
Yeah, I can't even look at that. I look away. So that's my cross to bear, though.
Yeah. You're doing a great job of it.
But anyway, when they're checking, when they scan something, that calculation is performed every time something is scanned to make sure that check digit calculates out that this is the correct price for this thing.
Yeah.
However, to me, fact of the podcast, the barcode does not contain a price.
No.
Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah. Remember we said the thing that the reason barcodes were invented was so that they can encapsulate information about that that item, right? One of the pieces of information that it encapsulates is price, but it also encapsulates how many are in stock, whether it's on sale, what tax you put onto it, who manufactures it, what size, some item description, all of this stuff. And it's all encoded in that bar, but no one thing is encoded into that. It's just that when you enter that number, either by scanning it into the computer or by punching those numbers in, that information goes to the point of sale computer in the store, and it returns all that information to the checkout.
Yeah, that's kind of the fact of the podcast for me, because like when you scan it, the price pops up, and I just automatically thought, well, sure, that's encoded in those bars.
Yeah, there is no way for you to look at a UPC symbol and discern the price.
Yeah.
Even if you can read the bars.
Yeah.
Because the price, one of the reasons it's invented, was so you can alter the price without having to go through and hand label everything. Remember, that was one of the reasons why.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. The problem is that means that there is such a thing as scanner scamming, which some state senator felt pretty good about him or herself for coming up with that phrase.
Yeah.
But there are some untoward retailers or merchants who will mess with the price of something and hope you don't notice and charge you more.
Even if it's by a few cents, we all saw Office Space. That adds up.
Yeah. That's
you know?
Right. Yeah.
And since we're there, you mentioned the Michigan law. I did look that up because they do have a law.
Yeah. I didn't yet.
Well, the result of the Michigan law against scanner fraud is the seller pays, and this is to avoid a lawsuit. Like you could technically bring a lawsuit against a company.
Yeah.
But they can just they can take care of it right here in Brainerd if they want to. So the seller pays the buyer the amount equal to the difference between the displayed price and the charge price plus an amount equal to 10 times that difference. So you think.
That's whopping.
Well, I mean, let's say you're charged $9.99 for something that's $8.99. Mm-hmm. So you get that dollar.
You get $1 million.
You get that dollar plus 10 times the difference with a maximum of $5. Because I thought, oh, man, you could really clean up if they really mislabeled like a TV.
Yeah.
But it's not.
No, up to $5.
Yeah, that's where they cut it off.
But that's a measuring stick for a good grocery store is without flinching. When they confirm that there has been a discrepancy between the scanned price and the price that they have on the shelves listed, that they just give you the item.
Here, oh, do they?
Publix does.
Okay.
That's why I'm a Publix shopper.
Right, that and the sheet cake.
It's really good. They also have this line of special limited edition ice cream right now. Yeah? And I want to declare everyone, if there's a Publix near you, get to the Publix, find their special edition toasted s'more ice cream.
Oh, yeah?
And enjoy arguably the greatest ice cream ever invented.
Is it good?
It's good. Good doesn't even begin to describe it.
Now, I've had a lot of s'more ice creams.
You're going to love this.
Is this better than other s'more ice creams?
Yes.
Okay.
You're going to love it.
Man, Publix needs to sponsor us. We throw them so much love.
They really should.
All right. Well, let's take another break, and we're going to come back after this and talk a little bit more about how these things are read. Hey friends, as every parent knows, kids seem to be everywhere all at once, and it's really tough for even the most watchful moms and dads to protect their little ones from every single thing.
Yeah, Duracell understands this, and that's why they're deeply committed to lithium coin battery safety. Lithium coin batteries power a bunch of important things around people's homes, including things young children may have access to. So Duracell not only educates parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of lithium coin battery safety, they also make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them.
Even Duracell's packaging is child secure and designed to avoid accidental opening. Because they believe their products should provide more than just power. They should also provide peace of mind. You can learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
All right. Another fact of the podcast for me is that the laser technically is scanning the white space between the black bars.
Both the black bars and the spaces.
Well, yeah. I mean, but it, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
I mean, is that like me thinking about it, like looking at a picture? Is it an old lady or a young lady?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
But to the scanner and the sensor, more directly, the sensor in the scanner that's getting the bounce back.
Right.
The black lines on a UPC code don't reflect back into the scanner. The white lines are the absence of the black lines,
yeah,
do. But both of those things, the fact that the light didn't bounce back there.
Well, there cannot be no white without the black.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very like Zen invention. The fact that some bounced back and some didn't means something to the computer that's attached to the scanner. And this is where the whole thing kind of gets translated into numbers, which then are put together to become the UPC number that is associated with the information associated with the item.
Right. So if you look at these bars, if you study, next time you pick up a can of soup, mm-hmm. turn it over and look at it, the very thinnest bar that you're going to see is 1 unit wide.
You can call it that?
Sure. And then every other bar that you see is either 1 unit wide, 2, 3, or 4 units wide.
Right.
And that's the maximum width is going to be 4 units.
Right. And so not just the bars are 1, 2, 3, or 4 units wide. The spaces are also 1, 2, 3, or 4 units wide, right?
Sure.
So there is, when you put a combination of spaces and bars together in the right way, you will end up, as far as the computer is concerned, with a 0 or a 1 or a 2. For example, to come up with a 0, you have a 3-unit wide bar,
mm-hmm.
a 2-unit wide space,
mm-hmm.
A 1-unit wide bar,
mm-hmm.
and then a 1-unit wide space. That's a 0. When you see that, what I just said,
mm-hmm.
go back, listen to it over and over again until you get it. That is that to the computer is a 0.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wonder if you would have messed that up if there would have been anyone that would be like, actually, Josh. It goes a little something like this.
Right, yeah.
That would be remarkable.
Maybe so.
I'm sure there are barcode wonks out there.
There has to be. I mean, there's just the fact that there's this major industry
yeah.
associated with creating and selling and leasing barcodes. Surely people can just look at it and know what they're saying.
I'm sure there are people ham radio hams.
Right.
A better into this.
It seems really complex and difficult to us, but if you step back, it's really simple. And being exposed to it day in and day out, you couldn't help but memorize it, I would think.
Are we on to the QR codes? Or?
Well, there's one more thing. If you look at a barcode,
uh-huh.
the first there are 2 lines and then the numbers start.
Mm-hmm.
There are another 2 lines in the middle, and then there are 2 more lines at the end.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And they are larger than the rest of the barcode.
Yeah.
Those are separators, guidelines,
yeah.
whatever you want to call them. And in the middle, those middle 2 lines actually cut the barcode in half. And when that happens, so that the barcode can be scanned any direction, the rules turn into the mirror image.
Yeah.
So where a 0 would have been like a 3-unit wide space followed by a 2-unit wide bar,
mm-hmm.
it would be a 3-unit wide bar followed by a 2-unit wide space and so on.
Yeah.
It's the same number. It's just the mirror image of it.
Right.
And that tells the scanner, hey, just go ahead and show off. Show everybody that you can read backwards and forwards.
Yeah. And that was, we didn't even mention at the beginning, there were specific specs
mm-hmm.
When everyone was developing those 7 submissions.
Right.
And one of them was, you got to be able to do these things forward and backwards, guys.
Yeah, in your sleep.
Yeah.
On a beanbag ashtray, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, there was also a size requirement, of course,
mm-hmm.
And other things like that. But forwards and backwards had to be in there.
Right.
I guess for, I don't know, convenience?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
I think that the Cincinnati pilot program, Bullseye one,
mm-hmm.
was touchy enough that they're like, it can't be like that. It's
right.
got to be like really tough and accurate.
You can just drop this thing accidentally and it'll ring it up.
Right.
Gotcha.
Which happens sometimes.
Yeah, it does. And then when you're doing it yourself, that's the only problem, is when you have a problem, because then you got to call the person over.
Oh, that's the worst.
And that person has to, you know, they're managing 8 different registers.
Move.
Yeah. And then the people in line behind you are like, oh,
God,
I should have just gone to the cashier line. This guy, he's no cashier.
I know.
He's no Diane.
Have you noticed also that retailers, companies, stores are
Why'd you just put that in scare quotes?
Hurting people more toward self-service by having fewer and fewer human-run checkout lanes open at a time.
Yeah?
Yep.
I haven't noticed that.
It's bugging me.
Yeah.
It bugs me.
So when you go to a store, do you have a friendly conversation with your cashier
no.
usually? You don't even interact then. You just
no.
like them having their job and being quiet about it.
I guess so.
Okay.
No, of course I do. I chat with people. I'm a friendly guy.
By the way, we should shout out. Was his name Brian? I was in a major big box flat pack furniture store. over the weekend.
Which one?
And a guy approaches me with a Josh sent me shirt.
That's awesome.
And I took a picture. He was very nice. I think his name was Brian. But he's like, I don't want to bug you. I was like, dude, you know, you're wearing a Don't Be Dumb shirt. It's right. Like, you got to come up to me and say something.
That was very cool.
And I asked if he minded if I took a picture of him, and I texted it to you.
I know. I got it.
And
I was like, Chuck's texting me on a weekend? This must be good.
He's quitting the show?
Can't take anymore.
Won't be there Tuesday, period.
Tell Jerry.
Yeah, it was kind of cool to see him out in the wild.
It was a great picture.
Anyway, back to QR codes. These are way more complex. If you look at a QR code or a 2D barcode, which, by the way, came around in 1987, which is hard to believe. I mean, it seems like at least a 2000s thing.
Yeah, you know? Easily.
But this, like we said, can store a ton more information vertically, horizontally. They use dots, hexagons, rectangles. They use bullseyes, which is kind of ironic. Mm-hmm. I don't, when I look at a QR code, I don't see any of those shapes.
You see like the one bigger shape mostly.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I just see a bunch of blocks and different
patterns.
Well,
yeah, that's the most universal one. Just like the UPC is the most universal 1D linear.
Right.
That QR code is a type of 2D code.
Oh, okay.
But there are ones that have tons of different like patterns and stuff to
gotcha.
Them.
Gotcha. You just got to stare at them, man.
Yeah. And then it all, you're like, oh, it's a donkey.
Right. What were those called? The
magic eye posters.
Yeah. I used to enjoy those.
Yeah.
I always got it eventually. I think we didn't do a show on these, did we?
I don't think so.
We've talked about it before.
That sounds like a short stuff to me.
It does. Let's do it.
Okay.
So QR codes work because like basically because everyone has a camera in their pocket now because you have to have a very complex reader on hand, and that is a camera, basically.
Yeah, if you run a product with a QR code through a supermarket scanner,
forget about
1D
it.
1D scanner, it'll say, like, does not compute, smoke will come out of it, it'll spin around.
Yeah.
It won't be good. So you need an image recognition software to scan a 2D code, but the camera on your phone does a really fine job, which is why you're starting to see them everywhere, like in museums on tours and things like that.
Yeah, I used one just the other day on a home security camera. Mm-hmm. They have a little QR code on the bottom.
Right.
And to get it going, you just point your camera at it and it locks it in.
I know exactly the one you're talking
Pretty
about.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So, Chuck, I think we've been kind of dancing around what's ultimately the biggest question of this whole podcast and really the reason we created it. Is the UPC code the mark of the beast? The devil's mark?
How did you know about this? Because I have never heard this. Have you heard this or did you just come across it?
I knew paranoid people in the 90s, so I was familiar with this.
So refer to our Satanic Panic episode as background, but apparently when these things started coming out, there were people, or maybe this is all urban legend.
No? I saw reference that Pat Robertson, somebody tried to link to a video of Pat Robertson on the 700 Club talking about this, and I couldn't find the video. But it's possible what you're saying. From what I saw, it started out as a real thing.
All right. Well, it all goes to the book of Revelation in the New Testament where, as everyone knows, if you've read the Bible, Revelation is when they talk about – it's when the Bible gets really good. And it's when it talks about the apocalypse and the beast and, you know, raining fire down from the heavens and stuff. And it says this. He causes all, both great and small, rich and poor, free and slave – to receive, and he is the beast, right?
Sure, yeah.
Satan.
Yeah.
To receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, didn't say back on the neck.
No.
That no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Somehow this got locked into the fact that barcodes were now on products.
Right.
Like that was the mark to sell.
Yeah, that was the thing that got everybody. Yeah. Oh, you need this to buy or sell. This is the mark of the beast. So that's how it started.
Right.
And then it evolved pretty quickly after that into just a straight-up urban legend and rumor that those guidelines, the two in the beginning, the two in the middle, and the two in the end, actually were encoded sixes.
It's a 666.
Which meant that every barcode in the world, or every UPC symbol in the world had 666 embedded in it, which clearly made it the mark of the beast.
Right.
And poor George Lehrer, who invented this, is like, no, I swear I did not create the mark of the beast. And apparently he got a registered letter once from Satan himself saying, how does it feel to have done my bidding, sucker?
I have 666 on the license plate of my pickup truck.
Do you?
Yes, by chance, which I kind of thought was great.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
You stole my Jesus fish, didn't you? there was one other thing that kind of helped the urban legend too, Chuck.
What's that?
The IBM scanners that were first put into use
were
models 3666.
What?
3666.
Well, there you have it.
Last thing, there was one thing I wanted to mention. We talked a little bit about how barcodes, we basically couldn't exist without them.
Right.
There's 5 billion barcodes are scanned every day. That GS1 site tracks it and basically says about 5 billion today.
Wow. All over the world, 5 billion.
UPC codes or barcodes of all kinds are scanned every day.
Wow.
And then the last thing is there is a company called Quiring Monuments that builds headstones that have QR codes engraved in them.
I've heard about those.
So that you can scan it as you're in a cemetery and it'll bring up like information and pictures of the deceased and talk about their life.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Instead of, you're not limited by the size of your gravestone.
No.
With just your name and like, you know, maybe a couple of sentences about your life.
You could have like a 1-inch by 1-inch gravestone. That's all you need.
That'd be kind of cool.
It's the wave of the future.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to know more about barcodes, you can go to a store and start studying them. Go do that now. Oh, wait. But first, listen to this listener mail.
I've been meaning to read this for a few weeks. We got a email from a woman named Maggie who works for a great organization. I'll just read it. Hey, guys, listen to your Selects episode recently about circumcision. Thank you for creating awareness about female genital mutilation around the world. I work with an organization in Kenya that rescues young girls from early forced marriage and female genital mutilation. Some of our girls have been rescued from this as early as age 8. We just recently rescued our 100th girl and have raised up every single one of them to graduate high school, which is a rare thing in this part of Kenya.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's very cool. Many have moved on to go on to college. Tribe girls in Kenya are raised to feel worthless and inferior to men and boys, and their only value is the dowry they can provide their father when he sells them for marriage. All of our girls have learned their worth and value, which empowers them to spread their message to other girls around them. They are wonderful girls and so happy now. The 2 times I had visited the last few years have been amazing, eye-opening experiences. It's good to see how quickly the girls blossom with some security, love, and protection. They are remarkable women. One girl I sponsored is 10 now, but was 8 when we rescued her. And to think she was going to be sold off as someone's wife at 8 years old.
My goodness.
I'd love for you to plug our website so your listeners can get involved if they want to support. It is saruni.org, S-A-R-U-N-I.org. There's a give tab at the top of the page, as well as lots of information on what we do. We specifically need funds to build more dorms and bathhouses for the girls. We are maxed out on beds, cannot take any more at the moment, so that is our next big goal.
I'm really glad you read this one, man.
Amazing. That's from Maggie, and again, it is saruni.org.
Thanks a lot, Maggie, not just for writing in, but for the work you're doing. That's
heck
really
yes.
amazing stuff.
Yeah.
If you want to get in touch with us like Maggie did and let us know about some amazing things you're doing, we'd love to hear that stuff. So you can go on to our website at stuffyoushouldknow.com and check out our social links there. Or you can send us a good old-fashioned email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's rainwater. Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.